Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids.
So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Mark Roberts. And about 10 years ago, I met Mark Roberts in Mysore, India. And I got to introduce myself, but I got to actually watch him practice. And so it's really exciting, to have him on the show because, you know, from the first time that I met him, I really looked up to him. He's doing a lot of amazing things in the yoga community, and I'm excited to have him on the show. So welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks, Taylor. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so I just want to get, for the listeners, a little bit of background information and tell them a little bit about who Mark was before yoga entered into the picture.
Oh, man. You want the short story or the long story?
Well, we only got 45 minutes. We only got 45 minutes.
So,
maybe the medium. Yeah,
the abridged version.
Cliff notes.
I mean, we can always circle back to that stuff if it comes up, I guess. Before I started yoga, which was in 1997, I took my first yoga class. I'd been dabbling with meditation. I'd been traveling around the world. I'd experimenting with meditation, vegetarianism, and sort of led me to my first yoga class. My mum took me to my first class. Before that, I was actually thinking I was going to be a scuba diving instructor.
Oh, wow.
I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was kind of had a few ideas going around in my head. One was as a travel journalist, scuba diving, and that were kind of the main things. I was trying to figure out a way to travel the world and to be able to make a living doing it.
Gotcha. And so
little did I know that 15 years later I'd be doing it, teaching yoga, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
Unexpected. Yeah.
It seems like you've always kind of been drawn to the ocean.
Yeah, that's right. I have been. It's been a big part of my life. I mean, coming from Australia, we have a connection with the ocean. I didn't start surfing, though, actually, until I was about 17 or 18, which a lot of people get surprised at that because they think that all Aussies grow up, surfing from the age of 3 or 4. And sometimes they do, but that wasn't the case in, my family. So I started, when I was later in my life, 18 is considered to be late to start surfing, actually. But it's never too late.
No, it's never too late to be in the ocean, that's for sure, and ripping the waves.
Yeah.
And so what was it like to go to your first yoga class with your mother?
It was a great experience. I remember, in those days, there weren't a lot of people doing yoga, so it was kind of a unique thing. And I think actually it was only my mother and myself were the only students in that class.
So you got some personalized attention.
Yeah, it was all kind of one-on-one in those days. And the guy, he was Asian. He was kind of had a bit more of a karate master kind of, he had like a Zen master, I'd say, kind of look about him, which was appealing to me at that time. And I just remember, really enjoying the physicality of the practice and also the meditative side of the practice. And then, I think everybody has that experience when you kind of walk out of a class after doing a shavasana and you feel like you're floating. I had that feeling, and I've heard other people say that they had that same kind of feeling. I really walked out onto the street and just, the world looked different. Felt like it was just, floating on air or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the main reasons why people practice, is because it not only you feel like you're floating, but like every problem that you have seems to be less as a result of just doing that, with doing the postures with the breathing, sends you on a completely different plane.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, and I think for me, the ocean is very similar, but in a different way. The ocean, as soon as you go in the water, it just cleanses everything, like all your worries and whatever thoughts all kind of disappear. So you feel very renewed, but it's not that same floating feeling. When you come out of the ocean, you feel kind of like really high or, you know, energized.
Yeah.
Something like that. It's a different sensation.
And so was that first yoga class that you took with your mom, was that like an Ashtanga class, or was that just like, you know, regular yoga?
Yeah, well, I didn't know what it was at the time, but, you know, a few years later, I kind of figured out what he was doing. And it was a bit of a mix between Iyengar and Ashtanga. And at that time, there was another guy in Sydney called Simon Borg-Olivier. You may have heard of him. He has a yoga school called Yoga Synergy. And so I found out that my teacher of that first class had been going to his classes. So he was taking some inspiration from Simon. And in those days, Simon was, mixing, kind of a vinyasa, Ashtanga vinyasa kind of style with Iyengar, you could say Iyengar principles. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how did you walk into your first, Ashtanga yoga class?
One foot in front of the other. or up the stairs. I remember it was on the...
Yeah, deer in the headlights. I feel like that's what everyone walks into, you know, their first Mysore class, and they're like, what in the hell is everyone doing here?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. The Mysore, I guess if a Mysore class was the first one, I might have had that experience. But, you know, it was that old school kind of style of yoga studio, you know, with the incense burning and a few pictures here and there, and just a small room that was pretty kind of intimate, cozy. It was not intimidating.
Gotcha. And what was your experience like with it?
Well, I got hooked, you know. I was like, pretty much from that first class, I was like, okay, yeah, this is definitely something that I want to do and pursue, and started to really get into it and to self-practice at home when I could. It kind of just led me from one thing to another. So I was still on the path of pursuing the scuba diving career. So I left Sydney, which is where I was living, and then I moved up to the Great Barrier Reef. And it's there that I found my next teachers, who were senior Iyengar teachers, but they were kind of, you know, dabbling in the dark side. They had a little Mysore kind of program going. But of course I didn't know what that was. It was just a kind of a self-practice group that they had going in conjunction with all their Iyengar classes.
Wow.
So that was.
And so how did you fit in there? How did you feel about practicing there?
Again, I loved it. You know, they were very inspiring. They were, at that time, I think both of them were on this fit for life diet. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it's where you only eat fruit.
No,
you eat fruit till midday, and you don't mix your carbs and proteins, all this kind of stuff. But that was kind of my first introduction into starting to think about, you know, diet and how that all kind of fits in with the practice. And I've told this story before, but, you know, listeners probably don't know this, that I got dengue fever at that time. That was in 98. That was when I was in Cairns in North Queensland. And I got dengue fever, and that really knocked me out. And at that time, I was still going to the gym. I was still running and doing other stuff. But my immune system really was affected. I got sick, and yoga was the only thing that I could do. And so because they were Iyengar teachers, they showed me these restorative sequences. And through that, I was able to really heal myself. And then that was kind of, that was when I was like, oh, wow, the yoga really has something, you know, powerful about it. And that was, you know,
Yeah, it has some healing power. Yeah,
exactly.
Sure.
So that was a further catalyst to be like, okay, yeah, this is definitely something that I want to pursue and go deeper into. So then I asked these guys, I asked these teachers, I said to them, look, I want to go to India. I want to find a master over there. Can you recommend anybody? And they gave me two options. One was Iyengar. There was a 3-year waiting list. And the other was Pattabhi Joyce, Mysore.
Gotcha.
So I was like, okay.
And so were you just like, I'm going to India. I'm going right away. And so I'm not going to wait that 3 years. Is that how you ended up coming to where Pattabhi Joyce was?
Yeah, pretty much. That was it. I had the travel bug as well. You know, I just wanted to go and see the world. But I needed to make some money. So I had to go back to Sydney for a while. And I was working a landscaping job, gardening and landscaping, saving my money. And then they told me about this place in Sydney called Yoga Moves, which is where Eileen Hall, back in the day, Peter Sanson was teaching there. Matthew Sweeney, a bunch of other people, really great teachers. So I started practicing there. That's where I got introduced to the proper Mysore style. And that was my connection to Pattabhi Joyce through those guys. And then,
wow.
So then once I saved up enough money, then I flew over to India.
It's crazy to hear you say that, that you're doing landscaping.
Yeah.
And, you know, that you're doing this stuff because, you know, I feel like so many people look up to you. And I don't know if you feel that or you feel some sort of pressure with that or whatever, but I think that there's a lot of people that really watch and pay attention to what you're doing. And I feel like there is, value in really every, whether it's your Instagram post or the other things that you're doing. It seems like you're putting out this huge value for the yoga community. And to hear you say like you were, trimming bushes and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Mowing lawns.
Mowing lawns. Yeah, it's crazy to me to hear you actually say that.
I would like to. And it's part of me that wouldn't mind going back to that, to be honest.
Why is that?
Just feel like getting, reconnecting with the soil, with the earth. And getting back into gardening and growing vegetables, growing food and all that kind of thing. So that's actually a plan because we're moving to Bali. We're going to buy a house in Bali. We're having a kid, as you probably know.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, time to, set up some roots. And I think that'll be, quite a good opportunity to get back into gardening and all that kind of stuff.
Sure. Well, I mean, it sounds like, you've traveled for a really long, a long time and not had those roots.
Yeah.
And so, it's due, especially with a baby coming,
I've been homeless for 20 years.
Yeah. It's crazy because, I have three children. And, with three children, it's like having a steady home is like one of the most important things that, you can have for them, some place where they can sit back and relax and learn and grow and maybe connect to the earth. And so that's an important part of, family for sure.
Yeah. And I guess traveling is not as fun when you've got three kids, right?
it's very difficult with three kids. You got to. I know your wife and I know that she's a strong woman, but I tell you, my wife is a strong woman that she gives me the ability to travel when I need to and, teach in the mornings and stuff like that. And I know that you got a supportive one too, but it's essential for us to, to do what we're doing. You got to have a good team member, good partner.
Great. Yeah. Well, I mean, basically I'm planning to cut back on the travel now.
So you're just going to stay in Bali?
That's more or less for a while anyway. We'll see how things, I guess when a kid comes, you can't really, it changes everything. So have to.
Never know.
Just go with the flow a bit.
Yeah. And so let's go back a little bit to, you showed up in Mysore, India, and, you had the travel bug and you show up in Mysore, India. Like, what was your experience like with, you know, like showing up in India?
Well, the first few months I was actually up in the north. So I arrived in Delhi and kind of was very shocked by what that was like. And then, you know, just the noise and people trying to rip you off and the poverty, the people with leprosy and all this kind of stuff. It was very, very intense.
What year was this?
This was 99.
Wow.
Yeah. And in those days, there was like power surges all the time. I mean, probably, I don't know if it's still happening in Mysore. It used to be like that in Mysore as well. Like the power just cuts all the time.
It's been pretty good the last few trips. But I mean, I remember like in 2010 and 2011, when I first started showing up here, that there was, actually two times a day, the power would go out.
Yeah. And I mean, like, so if I think about the first time I got to Mysore, there was no, pretty much you wouldn't get hot showers in any of the places where you'd stay. So you used to have the bucket showers.
Yeah.
You'd put like a metal prong inside the bucket to heat the water up.
Yeah. I think people are still doing that.
Oh, yeah. I kind of like those, but in those colder months, there's something, you know, quite fun about the bucket shower. And so obviously there was no Wi-Fi in those days. I remember there was one internet place, and it was right next to this kind of like, I don't know, it was some kind of a factory that had all these kind of petrol fumes. And,
oh, man.
You know, like it was hot, you can imagine, right?
Yeah.
And then if you wanted to make any changes to your travel plans, you had to go to an actual travel agency, and there was always a drama. You know, it was like it would take you a day.
Yeah.
Or if you wanted to, you know, if you needed to post something or receive something, you know, like dealing with the post office, all that kind of stuff. It was always, you know, and then you learn a lot also from the trials and tribulations of being in India in that sense. And also the food was kind of challenging, you know, like it was thalis for lunch and dinner or whatever. And it was dosa and upma or idlis, that's it for breakfast.
Yeah. I mean, even though that you're describing that it was like kind of difficult, I can also kind of hear a little like, you know, happiness in your voice. Mm-hmm. You know, did you have a lot of good times when you came to India?
Oh yeah, man! It was amazing. It was definitely. Although that being said, after I left Mysore, that first trip, I went on the road again up to Nepal, and I was traveling. In those days, I used to travel by bus and train everywhere, and and on that trip, I remember going to Hampi, and I was from Hampi to Agra. Somebody stole like stuff out of my bag, like my camera, I can't remember, a few other things. And then I was just getting hassled like everywhere. And then I remember in Varanasi, like just the intensity of that, I had a big breakdown. I had a big catharsis. And I actually swore that I would never go back to India again. And I changed all my plans and I went back to Australia.
Wow.
So, you know, India is kind of like, it was that love-hate relationship, I guess.
Sure. I mean, it kind of breaks you a little bit. It gives you something totally different.
Yeah. I mean, I think these days it's become much more. I mean, it's not like how it was. It's very modern now. You can live in style in India now, that's for sure.
Right. Yeah, it's much more posh here now. I mean, you can get all of the amenities. You can get Wi-Fi. You can get good food. You can eat a salad, which is crazy. Because I remember the first year I came here, we were like so dying for like greens. Like we wanted green food so bad, and it was like playing Russian roulette. You know, even if you cleaned it, you know, if you ate a piece of lettuce, you could be sick for the next 3 days.
That's right. Well, I mean, it's still a little bit like that. You still have to be careful.
Yeah, of course. So what was it like showing up to the Shala and practicing in the room that first time?
So the first, my first experience was actually trying to find the shala. That was, you know, I didn't, all I had was a yoga, all I had was a yoga mala and a picture of Pattabhi Joyce on the front. And I just went up to a rickshaw driver in the street and said, can you take me to this man? And then he took me on like a wild goose chase all over Mysore. Eventually I landed up at his house in Lakshmipuram. And that was in the afternoon, and I walked in and I met him. He was there with David and Simi Roach. I'm sure you probably know them,
yeah,
don't you?
Of course, yeah. I met David here.
Yeah. So I was so David and Simi were the first people I met, and then of course Guruji, and then so he first question was, "Who's your teacher?" And I said, Eileen Hall. And so that was kind of like, he's like, oh, okay, good. Did you write your letter? And I was like, yeah, I wrote my letter. You know, that was in those days when you used to write your letter, but you'd never receive a response as to whether it had been received by him or not. You just sent it off and you just went. And then he's like, okay, yeah, you come tomorrow. I can't remember if I had to pay him then or I had to come back the next day and do all that. But I seem to remember that I practiced the next morning. And I just remember, you know, arriving that and looking in at the shot, like the people practicing and just seeing all these bodies moving, sweating, the sound of the Ujjayi breathing, and just being like, wow, you know, this is, it kind of felt animalistic, I would say. That was kind of the thing that it struck me. I felt like, oh, this must have been what the yogis were practicing in the jungle.
Wow. You know?
And, yeah, just kind of, I enjoyed it a lot. I was, at that time, I was living in a house with a lot of the New York Jiva Mukti crew, because in those days, David, Life and Sharon, they were still going. So a lot of their teachers were going as well. And so that was kind of when I first got introduced to, you know, that New York Ashtanga Jiva Mukti scene, and introduced to Kirtan and all this kind of stuff. Yeah, it was super fun, you know, meeting people from all over the world. Obviously the practice was great to just dive into it, into that intense way.
Yeah. I think one of the questions, I think one of the questions that I actually sort of missed in the beginning is like, were you good at the practice? Like when you first started it, you know, because like in the intro, like, you know, I was really inspired because I don't know if you remember this, but I met you out front of the shala, you know, a decade ago, I guess.
Assisting in the shala at that time, weren't you, or was that another trip?
It was before. Yeah, it was before. That was, it was maybe like three or four years before that. And I got the 5 o'clock time slot, and I remember getting to watch you practice, and I was like, man, this guy is gifted. And so is this did you walk into yoga and were you like good at it from the beginning?
I mean, I guess you mean in terms of, was I flexible and strong?
Were you flexible and strong? Yeah.
I guess I was. I mean, I've always been athletic. I've played sports and stuff all my life. So I guess, yeah, probably I took to it. But, you know, I was a rugby player until I was 21.
Oh, so, man, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I stopped playing because I was not big enough. But otherwise, I would have probably wanted to pursue that as a, you know, more, if I had have been another 10, 20 kilos heavier. But that was not to be. So I mean, I guess I remember having sore hamstrings for the first 2 years, you know, like continuously sore. I do remember those teachers up in North Queensland, they used to say, oh, your backbending is your forte. I remember them saying that. So I must have had like a, you know, I've got a flexible lower back.
Gotcha.
Which, as you know, is not necessarily a good thing in the long run. Can and lead to problems.
Yeah, in the short term, it's really great because you can catch your heels and stuff in the deep back bends.
Yeah, yeah, but it doesn't mean you can do it without pain.
That's true. Yeah,
so, but to answer your question, I think it took me 2 years to finish primary.
Okay.
And it was funny because I had that conversation with Eddie once. I was practicing in New York with him, and he's like, how long have you been practicing or whatever? And I told him, he's like, yeah, that's about right. 2 years to finish primary, 4 years to do intermediate, and 8 years for advanced. And that was pretty much my journey, actually. It was 2 years wow. intermediate, 4 years, 2 years primary, and then I was finished intermediate 4 years later. And then it was 8 years for advanced A.
Wow.
And then, so now I'm thinking, so advanced B is another 16.
Yeah, and who wants to learn that anyways, right? Yeah,
exactly, exactly.
It just gets crazier and crazier. It's like more pain is coming as soon as you start doing more of that.
Yeah, some of those buses are a bit out there.
Yeah. Oh, well, I remember sitting, and it was basically one of the first few times that I'd ever seen advanced A, and you were practicing it, and I sat in that door, and I was like, wow, I'll never make it there, you know, like I'll never get to that spot or whatever, and you know, that those self-limiting beliefs. But I was really inspiring to see it, because this was maybe 2010 or 2011. And so I was watching you for, you know, half hour, 45 minutes, you know, go through advanced A, and it was like, man, it's a powerful practice. And
So yeah, that was the year I got, I finished advanced A that year, and that's the year I got certified, I believe.
It was just really cool to watch. And there was a lot of people that were practicing advanced A, but it was like, you know, some people are able to make it look easy, and other people like, you know, make it look more difficult, I guess, than what it is. But it was really kind of inspiring to watch. And so that's why I just wanted to ask whether or not, you know, like you took to it really fast. And so how many times have you been to Mysore?
Oh, man, I kind of stopped counting at some point. Basically, I went every year, more or less, from 9. So that was 99 was the first trip. And then my last trip was actually the season ending 2015-16. Yeah. So that was a good 16, 17 years, pretty much every year.
Wow. Yeah, that was the year that I was assisting. I remember you were practicing assisting. Yeah, I guess that must have been your last trip.
Yeah, it was the last one with the carpet on the floor, I believe.
Yeah, and then it went to the new wood floors or whatever.
Yeah, so. I've never practiced on that.
Yeah, it's quite nice, you know. But now, like, I'm in Mysore, India right now, you know, we're at the new
shala.
You know, we're at the new shala, and believe it or not, like, it's actually been quite a breath of fresh air. Like, it seems like a lot of things have just kind of shifted that have made it actually feel really good in there. I was a skeptic in the beginning.
Yeah, yeah. I heard people. Everyone really likes it. The new.
Yeah.
There's more room. You don't have to practice in the toilet anymore.
Yeah, that, you know, I never really liked practicing next to the toilet, like during lead class. I never wanted to fight for my spot, and I never wanted to practice next to the toilet.
Yeah.
And so do you have plans of coming back to Mysore? Do you feel like that's on your agenda for you?
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, Deepika wants to go back, so probably we'll go together, I guess. I'm not that. Like, it's not the top priority for me at the moment. I'm kind of like, I'm about to enter into the seventh series, you know?
Of course. Yes. It's a big series. Yeah. It's harder than advanced A and B.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I've been told. So I'm kind of just, that's kind of my main priority at the moment.
Yeah. And it seems like recently you kind of had a little bit of a falling out with, you know, was it with Sharad or being taken off the list, or, you know, like, it seems like there was a little bit of falling out between you guys or, you know, the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's been a few things going on in the last few years, which have not been so good, but I guess we, you know, all through the challenges we grow, right?
Sure.
So that kind of started around 2017. Yeah, that was when I got wind that I was going to get taken off the list.
For what?
That was for teaching incorrect method, basically. Yeah, someone had told him that I was doing, you know, different stuff in my workshops. And then I got taken off the list, which, you know, so I didn't really appreciate that, to be honest. Just that.
No, did it hurt? Yeah. Did it hurt your feelings?
Oh, yeah. It was, you know, in a couple of ways. One is just that kind of feeling that there are people in the Ashtanga community watching what I'm doing, and then, like, you know, like you're at high school and then telling on me to the teacher. You know, so it kind of creates that culture of fear, you know, or sight, wanting to, you know, you feel like you can't be yourself. So that's,
yeah, that's terrible. And people have actually tried to do that to me too. I call them like the Ashtanga fundamentalists. Yeah. They're like the one percenters that make the most noise, and they go into Sherat and they, you know, like show them your Instagram and say like, oh, this isn't a pose that you've taught him, Sherat. It's like, you need to take him off of the list. Yeah. It's such bullshit.
Yeah. So this kind of is like such really petty behavior, right?
Right.
So it's all this kind of political stuff that, you know, I just don't want to be a part of. And then, yeah, I guess I also didn't appreciate the fact that, like, if he had a problem, then why wouldn't he just reach out and talk to me about it? You know, like reach out and say, hey, what are you doing? I've heard, you know, you've been doing this and that or whatever, instead of just be like, suddenly I'm off the list. So that was the first one. And then I sorted that out by writing to Usha and et cetera, et cetera. And I just basically said, look, you know, I teach Mysore style. We do lead classes. We teach chanting philosophy, you know, and we teach other workshops that kind of help for the students to better understand their practice. So then again, it was at the end of, the end of 2017 was, you know, when Karen Rain came out with the Me Too, and then also Mary Taylor came out with her blog, and I wrote something on there. It was a Facebook group which no longer exists, but it was some Facebook like Ashtanga teachers group, and I remember I wrote something about the whole, you know, Patavi Joyce thing, and just saying, you know, like, I can't believe that, you know, that I kind of feel sad, or I feel lied to, I guess, in a way, and I felt like that the senior teachers, as well as Sharad and Saraswati Manju, etc., need to speak about it. And then the next thing, I was off the list again. So
that's rough.
But then that was not the only one who was taken off the list. That was all the, you know, legends went off, like Richard and Tim Miller and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that was a kind of a really insecure time where everyone was, you know, a lot of Ashtanga people were sitting there going like, you know, why was someone like Mark Roberts taken off the list, or Tim Miller or Richard Freeman or all of these guys taken off the list. I it was definitely like a real, you know, insecure time.
Yeah.
And then you mix this sort of with, and you mix it with the Karen Rain's, you know, accusations and all of that stuff. And we were all kind of like left wondering, you know, like what is actually going on.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And then,
So how did that stuff affect you, Mark? I mean, how did the Karen Rains and Mary Taylor coming forward, like, how did that affect you? I mean, did you consider Patavi Joyce your guru?
I didn't consider my guru, but, you know, I was very grateful, you could say, I would say, for him, for, you know, for the practice and how it had helped my life and changed my life. I felt saddened by it all. It was kind of, it brought up a lot of stuff, you know. It was also, it made me think about all the, over the years, all the times when, you know, I had been adjusted and, you know, had been like feeling like the adjustments were, you know, dangerous or injurious, painful. And instead of speaking out and saying something to my teachers, not just Patavi Joyce, but other teachers of mine, instead of saying something, I kind of avoided the conflict and just, you know, it was like I would just relax and I would breathe and I would surrender and do all those kind of things, you know. And then I would just, when this all started to come out, I just felt this a bit of, you know, like anger, I guess, and just pain that I'd also, And then I could also relate to Karen Rain, or, you know, the fact that she had not said anything either. Because in that situation, you know, sometimes you don't want the confrontation. And also you feel like if you say anything, you know, like your peers or the community, they're going to judge you. You have that, there's a feeling of being on an outsider, or you might become an outcast. So there's...
Yeah, well, or they end up doing, like, you know, going and talking to Sharap behind your back or something, like, you know, or Patavi Joyce behind your back or whoever it is. Yeah, so I can... definitely gives a weird feeling. And you know, to be honest with you, that doesn't feel present here today. You know, as I sit in Mysore, it doesn't feel, you know, there was a time where I felt like it felt very gossipy. It felt very high school, all of that stuff. But I feel like a lot of those people, Mark, have dropped off. They're not here anymore. And the health of the community is definitely here today. Which, you know, even, you know, in just my experience over the last 10 years, I could say that, you know, there was times where it didn't feel healthy to me, you know?
Well, yeah. That's good to hear. I mean, this one issue that I still have, though, is like the whole catching thing. Like, I just don't get that at all, to be honest.
You don't want to catch anymore?
I don't get like the whole emphasis on that, and I don't see that as, like, you know, as being healthy.
Yeah, it's pretty intense, that's for sure. And especially when you know, there's some people that don't know how to do it that are helping people do it.
So,
you know, because it's a really intense thing.
And like, as I was mentioning, just because someone is flexible in the lower back, like I am, doesn't mean like I can get there, but then I suffer for it the next day. You know, so I think that's like, it's almost like that's the last thing that Sharad just can let, if he could just let go of that obsession, then we would be at that place where we could say, yeah, this practice is healthy, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I felt was really amazing about, you know, the shifts that have happened, not just the shala, is the fact that, you know, there's actually cards, like consent cards, you know, like, hey, I'm injured, leave me alone. There's also I'm pregnant, you know, leave me alone. I'm also, I don't want adjusted today. And that seems like a huge step in the right direction. And also the fact that, you know, this goes a little bit to your point, where, like, when I came here, it was like, you know, there was sort of like this strict upbringing where, like, if you were at Kapotasana, you had to catch your heels. And I see a lot of people today, not the catching and backbends, like, that's a different story, but I see a lot of people today able to make more modifications, and it's actually much softer than what it was when I first showed up here.
That's good. Great to hear. That's good.
Yeah. It's been a kind of a breath of fresh air, because then it becomes a little bit more inclusive instead of like this exclusive club that everyone can hang out
at. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, as we all know, it's not about the asana in the end, is it? So
No. Why don't you talk a little bit about your philosophy on the practice? Because I feel like, you know, you're kind of on your own level. What do you feel about the practice today? It's that it's not all physical.
I mean, also bringing in the meditation. I know we can say the practice is a moving meditation, but actually sitting and doing, you know, what we think of as a meditation practice, I feel this is an important element. Also some kind of breath work, pranayama. And again, yes, the asana practice has that element of connecting breath with movement, which is beautiful. And that's one thing I would say, like, as with all the movement exploration that I've been doing outside of the Ashtanga practice, one thing I've noticed is that the Ashtanga practice really, that's one of the elements that is so unique and special about it, is it really teaches you how to connect with your breath as you move. And that's been like a really valuable tool for me to bring into other movement disciplines that I'm exploring. And I feel like, yeah, you know, so with those elements, you know, connecting movement with breath or being very mindful of breath and being mindful of what's happening within the body, the sensations arising, this can be applied to, you know, anything that you're doing in terms of whether it be handstands or going for a run or whatever. And then combining that with a meditation practice, you get this very similar feeling as you would from doing the Ashtanga practice.
Yeah. And so why do you show up at the top of your mat every day?
Just what I do, man. Just what I do.
I mean, why are you inspired after so many years to continue to do this or to continue to do it? It's hard. You know, like, does it make you a better person, or do you feel differently still today as a result of doing these postures and doing this breathing and being focused on your mat?
It's this is something I have been definitely asking myself. Like, you basically, it's like the why do we do this? You know, why? Yeah. It's a good question. For me, I've seen massive transformation over the years. When I think back to who I was as a teenager compared to now, it's, you know, definitely the practice has transformed me in a very positive way. But I feel like now I've reached a point where I feel quite content, I would say, quite satisfied in who I am as a person. So now it's almost like, it's like an unfolding. I guess what I'm trying to say is there's less striving now than there was when I was in my 20s and 30s. You know, there was definitely, yeah, in those days, there was like kind of, I was trying to get somewhere. You know,
ambitious.
I was ambitious for sure. Even ambitious to get enlightened, you know. Kind of an oxymoron, but that was, you know.
Yeah. It is an oxymoron, yeah.
Yeah, so I think now it's just the fascination with, like, learning, discovering. Also, there's an element of maintenance within for the body, just to keep the body feeling good, feeling healthy. Also, for just state of mind, to keep that mental clarity and peace throughout the day. But in terms of like asana, like a lot of that, I'd say most of that ambition has gone now. Like, I feel satisfied with what I achieved getting up to where I got to. So now it's kind of just about, you know, maintaining at a healthy level and, you know, probably going, well, as you see my Instagram, so I'm exploring other forms of movement. What I've been getting into is
what inspired you to go down that path, to kind of exploring different disciplines?
It was kind of probably always there as a seed in the background, but I was occupied with the Ashtanga practice, you know, that kept me busy for a long time. And then I reached a level in the Ashtanga where it was like, oh, you know, I'm kind of, it's not, I don't really, like, as you said, I don't really want to do the rest of fourth series.
Mm-hmm. You maxed it out. Yeah. I'm trying to give back poses now.
And so it's like, oh, okay, let me see what else this body can do. Let me, you know, explore other forms of movement and let's make, you know, let me utilize what I've learned from the Ashtanga practice and put it to good use, learn some acrobatics and learn a few different things. But what I'm kind of getting more into recently, I've been exploring just this whole idea of evolutionary biology and just the concept of, you know, what a human's actually programmed to do.
What do you mean by that?
Of our genome, what is our genome like programmed to do in terms of evolution, the evolution of our species? And it's pretty simple, really. Basically, we're meant to walk, run, crawl, jump, balance, lift, carry, throw, catch, and swim, and climb. So these are kind of all the essential natural human movements. So what I started, I've just taken this from MoveNat. I don't know if you've heard of MoveNat. I just did a certification with them.
Awesome. I have not heard of it.
Like when I look at that and I think about what I've been doing with the Ashtanga practice, it's like, oh, there's a lot of elements there that are missing. You know, the climbing, for example. You know, the running, the jumping. I mean, we have jump backs, but it's on our hands, jumping with your feet, you know.
Right. Being able to. And so do you think that you can find yoga? Do you think you find your yoga through, you know, some of these other movements?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still all the same principles. You still have to have good posture. You know, your position needs to be correct. Your breathing needs to be correct. You know, the sequencing of your movements, the timing, all these kind of things, all the same principles of learning to be efficient in your movements. Everything that you apply into the asana practice carries across to all these other movement practices.
Yeah. You know, I hear you talk a lot about, you know, like movement and stuff like that and transformation and things, you know, along those lines. But has the practice been spiritual for you as well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that was my main driver in the early years. I mean, not urgent to say early years throughout, but I think now, like, being married and having a kid, it kind of changes things. Whereas like when I was in my 20s or teens, 20s, 30s, I was really searching, you know, searching for the meaning of life and, you know, I was wanting to have that experience of samadhi, enlightenment, all that kind of thing. You know, but to be honest, I realized over the years was there was a lot of running away. It was coming from a place of not wanting to feel pain. You know, like I kind of felt like I could meditate my way out of pain. If I could just concentrate hard enough, if I could hold my breath long enough and do all the asanas, that somehow I would be able to get to a place of, you know, peace and blissfulness that would last forever.
What pain were you running from though, Mark?
I guess heartache, heartbreak were a couple of the main ones, but I think it goes deeper than that, you know, like back to childhood. I think even just the fear of death, I think that's kind of one of being the big driver for me. because I remember as a young kid, like very, very young, 3 or 4 years old, just kind of having these realizations of, you know, the fact that the universe had been here for billions of years before I had arrived. And then after I was going to die, it would continue for billions of years and I would just be in the abyss somewhere. And I remember kind of like just feeling fear around that. And I used to always like have this feeling, okay, it's okay. I would, you know, self-soothe. I would talk myself out. I would just be like, okay, it's okay. By the time you're an old man, you will have, you know, you'll be ready for it. And so that kind of feeling has come to me many, many times over the years. It used to come a lot when I'd be doing Shavasana. I'd be lying there in Shavasana and then suddenly I'd just get this wave of like this feeling of my mortality. And then I'd just be like spurred into action. I'd just wake up and go, okay, like let go of whatever dramas I'm having with people and then just make the most of life, you know, seize the day kind of thing.
Yeah. And it's funny because I've experienced the same thing that's come to me, and it's happened more as I started having kids.
Oh, okay.
You know, because you start, yeah. And I mean, not to break it to you or whatever, I'm sorry. But you know, you start realizing that, you know, you're the primary breadwinner for your kids, or you're providing the stability that they need in order. And, you know, all of a sudden it's like, there's a certain level of importance to you being there,
yeah, right.
Which I think, you know, obviously like adds a totally another layer onto, you know, this fear of not being here.
Yeah.
And so it's been one of the things that I've worked on a lot to, you know, to make sure that they're okay, even if I am not, if I'm not here.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I guess that's going to be my next role in life, you know, just being protecting and making sure that my child's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. What stuff do you have going on this year? You know, I know that you said you're moving to Bali. Like, is there, you know, you have plans in Bali to host retreats or workshops?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, first of all, is the baby's coming. So end of April. So we're going to be in India for that. So we go back to India in March. And we'll basically stay in India until Deepika's recovered. And then we'll be back in Bali. And then I've got a 1 month intensive happening in August.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Maybe I'll do some other stuff or, you know, get Deepika back working as well by September, October, hopefully. So yeah, but I just wanted to take that time, you know, to be there for her and just be able to support her for the first few months.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big deal to have. Yeah, with having the dad there and like being supportive and taking care of your wife when she needs you the most, and the baby as well. That's an important time for sure.
Yeah. So I'm fortunate to be in that position that I'm able to do that at the moment. I'm thinking about starting maybe do a bit more online teaching. That's a way to, you know, instead of traveling. So it's a good option, I think.
Sure. I feel like a lot of people get a lot of value out of your post. And so I feel like the online courses would be perfect for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm very over Instagram. So I'm just really trying to reassess my relationship to that and where I'm going to go in terms of connecting to people, you know, on social media or whatever. But seems, I don't know, I feel like I'm not the only one who's pretty over Instagram. It feels like it's coming to an end.
Yeah, I'm feeling like a little tired of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So, well, Mark, I want to thank you for being on the show and, you know, sharing your story and, you know, your journey. And I want to, you know, congratulate you,
thank you.
And you and Deepika for, you know, the child that's coming. And, you know, in your success, like over this next year. And I really appreciate you being on the show and sharing your heart and soul.
Thank you very much, Taylor. It's a pleasure.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit AshtangaYogaColumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is TaylorHuntYoga.com. See you guys next time.